I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The results of Tuesday's primary are in. Well, most of them anyway. Democratic candidate Christine Hallquist will face incumbent Republican Governor Phil Scott in November. Peter Welch and Bernie Sanders both won the Democratic nominations for the seats they already hold, though Senator Sanders will likely turn down that nomination and run as an independent. Brooke Page won the GOP nomination for 5, maybe 6 offices, though he may not be on the November ballot for all of them. And there are a few surprises in the nominations for Vermont's legislature. Today on the show, we will talk about all of these results and how the race to the general election in November is now shaping up. Joining us for this conversation is veteran political journalist and Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jane.
And from the Middlebury College studio, political science professor Matt Dickinson. Matt Dickinson, nice to talk with you again.
And nice to talk with you, Jane.
All right. So let's go talk first about the Democratic gubernatorial contest. This was one that was watched not only in Vermont, but all over the country. You could see the alerts coming in last night as Christine Hallquist was declared the victor in the Democratic primary. And this made news around the country. But let's talk first a little bit about just those results themselves. Bob, how close was the race and what happened?
Well, you know, the race was not all that close. I think a lot of political pundits thought that there could be a strong three-way race between Christine Hallquist, James Ehlers, and Brenda Siegel. But it turned out to be a smashing victory for Hallquist with basically a 2-to-1 margin over the other two candidates. So it was a very strong victory. She ran very strongly in almost all parts of Vermont. Now, Brenda Siegel is from the southern part of the state in the Brattleboro area, and she did well there. But Christine Hallquist ran very strongly in southwest Vermont, up in the Northeast Kingdom, in the Chittenden County, Washington County, Windsor County. So I was really impressed at how broad the support was for Christine Hallquist.
Professor Dickinson, you same?
Yeah, I agree with Bob. One of the interesting things was the turnout. I haven't seen the final totals, but last night while I was in studio, I was doing a rough calculation. It looked like it was going to be north of 60,000 in the Democratic primary. That is more than I expected. We've had problems attracting turnout in the primary since we moved into early August. These were four candidates whose name recognition, as you know, from your own poll was quite low. And so the worry here was whoever came out of this would not have a substantial claim to a mandate among their own partisan voters. And I don't think that happened. I think Christine Hallquist not only won decisively, but she won decisively in a relatively well-attended primary.
Why do you think the primary was well-attended? I mean, this is what we may be seeing across the country, Democrats energized to vote. Could that be part of a more national push to get Democrats interested in voting?
I think that may be part of it. Certainly, Hallquist made a point of saying one of the incentives for her to run was Donald Trump's election as president. And we have seen, as you point out, heightened enthusiasm among Democrats in national races across the country. I also think, though, this was, as Bob pointed out, viewed as a competitive race. And these candidates, although their name recognition was low, they made a concerted effort to get out there and mobilize people. And so there was a lot of interest. And of course, there were some personal dynamics involved here. We centered a lot of our discussion on Christine being a historic candidate. But of course, you had Ethan, who got incredible national exposure quite late. And so there were a lot of personal stories that I think may have also contributed to the higher than expected turnout.
Yeah, Ethan Sonneborn, 14. So, you know, much was made of the fact that he couldn't vote. And people kept calling this a quirk in Vermont's electoral laws. And that sort of rubbed me the wrong way. Bob Kinzel, do you have a sense of whether or not it is actually a quirk that somebody doesn't have to be a registered voter in Vermont in order to run for office and that there's no age limit? Or was that perhaps actually intentional? This is just the way our electoral laws work in this state.
You know, I'm not exactly sure, but I think it probably was intentional. Another quirk is if you run for a federal office in any state, you don't have to be a resident of that state until election day itself, which I find to be a sort of an interesting quirk. So I think
allows Rocky De La Fuente to run in as many states as he runs in.
Exactly.
Huh. Matt Dickinson, I saw a tweet today from somebody saying, wow, look at this. Christine Hallquist won or had more votes in her favor in the Democratic primary than Phil Scott had in the Republican primary. And, you know, not every vote has been counted yet, but it looks like Christine Hallquist got about 27,500 votes. Phil Scott got about 24,000 votes. Of course, these are two separate races at this point. But the person I saw was saying maybe this bodes well for November. Can you actually make that comparison given that these were two different races and essentially two different sets of voters?
You really can't. Historically, the Democratic turnout in a blue state tends to be higher. The victor in the Democratic primary, again, depending on context, tends to receive more votes. But we've had Republican governors come out of these primaries and do quite well in the general election. Keep in mind, I just said there was relatively high turnout, historically speaking, in the primary. But I don't have the final numbers. Again, doing a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation, I think turnout might have been 20% of registered voters. You can correct me if you got the source there.
Mm-mm.
It's going to double in the general election. So there were a lot of people who sat home, and many of them are moderates. Many of them will be inclined to vote Republican. So I would not read too much into the fact that in the primary, a low turnout affair by definition, Hallquist got slightly more votes than did the incumbent. Keep in mind, we haven't defeated an incumbent governor in decades in this state. So I wouldn't overreact to that.
I want to get into that comparison and that race now that we have between Christine Hallquist and Phil Scott. But before we do, while we're talking about the turnout, we got a note from the Burlington Republican Party chair, Paco DeFrancis, who says the pundits consistently said, quote, this will be a low energy, low turnout primary going into the election, noting they'd expect less than 20,000 GOP ballots cast. Turnout for the GOP primary was about double that. So what do you attribute the higher than anticipated voter turnout to? And what do you think this indicates for November? Matt Dickinson, I'll go to you first because you were just talking about this. So what about Paco's question?
Well, he's right to point out that this was historically, at least in recent primaries, a relatively high turnout affair. Of course, we had an issue here that a lot of us were uncertain how it was going to play out, and that was gun control legislation and whether there'd be a backlash. And what it turns out to be is we talked earlier on one of your shows that Governor Scott made a calculated risk here, willing to alienate his base on the assumption that it would position him more effectively in the general election. And I think he won that risk. It turns out that although the gun owners' social network sites were really active, it didn't translate into a lot of anti-Scott votes. In fact, if anything, he may have benefited from that in the Republican primary. So I think that was one of the issues that drove energized the Republican base here to send a message that they were still backing Phil Scott despite that focus on that one particular issue.
But Keith Stern, who was going up against Phil Scott in the Republican primary, won about a third of the vote. He's got at 32% of the vote. Wouldn't you expect a popular incumbent in his own party's primary to do better than 66%, Matt?
Well, he in his previous run, and again, he wasn't the incumbent against Bruce Lisman. He won a slightly lower amount, so.
But he wasn't an incumbent. I mean, that seems to me a totally different race.
Well, I wouldn't say totally different, but you're absolutely right to point out that incumbency confers certain name recognition. Although Scott already was a highly visible candidate from his prior experience as a lieutenant governor. So I wouldn't want to discount the 2016 total percentage as an indicator of what we should expect. You know, you can parse numbers anyway. One of the problems is we don't have exit polls, so we can't break that down on the particular issues that motivated people. And sure, kudos to Keith Stern. But you'll remember a lot of us were predicting single-digit turnout in the Republican primary here under anything under 20,000, we thought, might spell disaster for Phil Scott. So I think he'll take this.
Bob Kinzel, what do you think? I mean, we do have this higher than average turnout, higher than expected turnout in the GOP primary. We also, though, have the question of how many Democrats might cross over to vote for Phil Scott in support of his position on gun rights. And they had to choose whether they wanted to take a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot or a progressive ballot, which I'll note had no candidates' names listed on it. So, you know, we don't necessarily have a sense of even how the people who voted for Christine Hultquist in the Democratic primary might vote for governor in the general election. What's your take?
My take, Jane, is that for Keith Stern, that's about the same number, I think, of Vermonters who support President Trump in recent polls. It's around the 30% mark, the hardcore Republicans. Phil Scott has made no effort to support Phil Scott on a number of issues, be it immigration, be higher tariffs. And so I think the really hardcore Republican voters, you know, it's about 30%. And that's what I would expect from Keith Stern. And as you mentioned, the gun rights people were a little split. Were they going to try to go in the Republican primary and vote for Keith Stern or write in John Rogers in the Democratic primary? I think John Rogers, we don't know exactly how many votes he got, but it's in the neighborhood of 5%. And I think that just shows you how difficult it is to have a write-in campaign for governor and that maybe there weren't all that many people who were supporting Rogers.
Amy is calling in from Windsor. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I would like to know what was the total on the votes for Ethan Sonneborn. And I did vote for Ethan, not because I thought he would win, but what I was hoping for was to encourage his contemporaries, the young people, to get involved as Ethan did. And I don't even own a TV, so I didn't have any access to the totals. But how many votes did the young man garner?
Amy, thanks for your call. Again, not fully reported here, but as of just before noon today from the Secretary of State's office, it looks like Ethan Sonneborn got about 4,600 or 4,700 votes, which is a little over 8% of the total in the Democratic primary for governor. So James Ellers and Brenda Siegel were both ahead of him. They both had about 22%, 22% of the vote, and Ethan came in fourth. Ethan was tweeting this morning. He said he called Christine Hultquist last night to offer his support. But Ethan also taking aim at James Ellers. And I'll read you his tweet. This is Ethan Sonneborn's tweet. He says, James Ellers should not run as an independent. Christine for VT is our nominee. Last night I called Christine to offer my support. I know that James is disappointed. I am too. But Democrats have spoken and the race is over. We must work as a united party to defeat Governor Phil Scott. Now, Bob Kinzel, what Ethan's referring to there is that James Ellers has not yet said that he will endorse Christine Hultquist, and he has not actually confirmed that he won't run as an independent.
That's right. And what does it say about Ethan that he gets involved in this way? You know, I think that 8% of the vote for Ethan is really remarkable. Now, had he been any other typical 14-year-old, I don't think he would have done that well. But he was a good candidate. He, as we learned in the different debates and at our VPR debate, he had really thought through his position on a lot of issues. And I think he showed that young people want to get involved in politics, can look at some complex issues and come up with some reasonable solutions. So I think that 8% says a lot of people in the Democratic primary found Ethan Sonneborn to be a credible candidate, and they look forward to him running again.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see, and interesting to see him. You know, you have to look at that tweet and see the 14-year-old saying to the adult man, I know he's disappointed. James, I know you're disappointed. I am, too. It's kind of a remarkable situation to be in. So let's look a little bit at this now race that we have between Christine Hultquist and incumbent Governor Phil Scott. What do you think now, now that we know who's up against whom, what, Matt Dickinson, are you going to be looking at as this race progresses in terms of where they really find daylight in their policy ideas and then also how other people, maybe I'm thinking national organizations, coming into the race perhaps with funding?
So two great issues there that you mentioned. Let me take the second one first. The historic nature of Christine Hultquist's victory means that she has achieved something that challengers to an incumbent dream of, which is name recognition. And in some ways, the national reaction, even the international reaction, I heard the BBC touting her victory earlier today, means that she is going to tap into activist donors. These people are going to contribute money from out of state in small bills, and that's going to allow her to run a very well-publicized campaign without relying on sort of corporate money or these big donors. Not to say the Democratic Governors Association won't pitch in here as well. So that's really a boon to her. Having said that, these outside activists can't vote. So she has to run on an issue set that's going to appeal to constituents. And here's where Scott's strength is. As a Republican governor, he can make the case that we need to balance off control of the state legislature with these big spending Democrats, with somebody who can veto these bills and protect the taxpayer. That's been the Republican playbook for winning the governorship before. Jim Douglas was a master at this, and I expect Phil Scott to do the same thing. So I think the strategies are pretty clear here. I am interested and I'm interested in what Bob says about this, about the interesting personal story that Christine brings to the table. It can complicate running for governor because you don't want that to dominate discussion on her side. And Scott's got to be very careful that when he attacks her, it's not immediately translated into an attack on identity issues as opposed to attacking her on the issues.
Yeah, Bob, I'd love your take.
Well, I think what's going to happen here is that Christine Hultquist and Phil Scott are going to treat each other with an enormous amount of respect. And they'll find some issue differences, of which there will be many. Let's look at raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Hultquist is in favor of that. Scott is against it. Paid family leave. Hultquist is for it. Scott is against it. The idea of funding education using the property tax, I think Phil Scott showed during the session that he was happy to use and wanted to use one-time surplus money to lower property tax rates. I think Christine Hultquist has a very different point of view. Tax and regulate marijuana could be an issue in this campaign. Should there be universal health care for all Vermonters? Christine Hultquist would say yes, and Phil Scott would say it should be done through the private market. So I think we have a lot of issues that are going to separate these two candidates. And I think, as Matt said, they're going to treat each other with a lot of respect. What I worry about is the outside groups. There's going to be so much money coming in from outside groups. And I'm not thinking of small donors from around the country. I'm talking about the big PAC organizations and the RGA and the DGA. They're going to just flood the airwaves with money. And I think it's very possible that it's going to get really nasty. The RGA has already started. They put out a press release last night saying if you support Christine Hultquist, you're supporting someone who wants to raise your taxes by tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. The DGA is going to be in here very soon talking about Phil Scott as an uncaring, pro-business, anti-worker person. You know, do you know the real Phil Scott? He doesn't care about you. We're going to have all this negativity from the national level. And, you know, and I was thinking back to the 2006 race in Vermont for the U.S. House, and that was Peter Welch and Martha Rainville. And they made it very clear to outside groups they did not want negative ads in that campaign. Now, it was also pre-Citizens United, so that could have had a big impact as well. But I wonder if Hultquist and Scott will get together and say, hey, there's a good campaign here on the issues. Let's campaign in a positive manner, and let's tell the outside groups, if you're going to have a negative message, just stay away.
Let's take a quick call here from Bill in Eden. Hi, Bill. What are you thinking about?
Well, I listened to earlier to Mr. Kendall's.
Oh, Bill, your line is not very good. We're not hearing you. Try one more time here. Nope. I'm sorry, Bill. We don't have you. We'll try to get you back later in the program. Matt Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College. Bob Kinzel is a longtime Vermont political reporter. They are with us today going over some of the primary results from yesterday and looking ahead to the general election campaign season, which we are now officially in. Before we come back to Matt Dickinson and Bob Kinzel, I'd like to catch up now with Jack Moulton, who's executive director of the Vermont Republican Party, to just talk a little bit about the GOP strategy going forward now that candidate Brooke Page has won so many nominations. Jack, thank you for coming into the studio.
No
I appreciate
problem,
it. So H. Brooke Page ran for 6 positions on the Republican
yes.
ballot. He has won the GOP nomination for U.S. House, Auditor, Attorney General, Secretary of State, and Treasurer. It still hasn't been called yet in the Senate race, although it looks like right now he's leading Lawrence Zupan by a little over mm-hmm. 400 votes. So 6 potential positions. Obviously, he can't fill them all. And he has said he's sort of a placeholder candidate. He's willing to withdraw. So first of all, what do you think about Brooke Page?
I mean, Brooke's great. He obviously is capable of winning 6 different elections at the same time. So,
but is that because you don't put up any other candidates?
I mean, he ran in 2 contested races and won both. But, you know, we have a ton of other candidates that are great. But Brooke's shown that he's able to win elections even in a contested primary.
But he's not going to be on the November ballot in all of those
right,
positions.
Right. Yeah. I've spoken with Brooke Page. He's interested in, like you said, being a placeholder candidate who is there during the election and then it steps aside for whichever race he doesn't want to run in. I do believe there's some statutes where he's actually allowed to serve in a majority of those positions if he did win all of them. But the voters decided. They picked Brooke Page for what looks like is going to be all 6 elections. So we have to work with him and figure out which seats he's not interested in pursuing through November and work to appoint somebody.
Right. So just to be clear on what the rules are mm-hmm. here, he can – if there's nobody who wins the Republican nomination, then the Republican Party can appoint someone, right? And mm-hmm. if Brooke Page has won but steps aside, the Republican Party can nominate someone. And the time crunch here is that in order to get a different candidate on the ballot in November, you have to do that relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have potential candidates in mind for all of those positions should Brooke Page step aside?
Yeah, and Brooke's been a part of that. We've worked to identify people that would be interested in those positions and would be interested in an appointment post-primary process. But we do have to work through, you know, Brooke needs to decline the position if he wants to. And then we have to appoint a committee. The state committee votes on who the appointment is. It all has to be done before 45 days before the election. And it's going to be a process of getting this done.
Have you spoken to Brooke today or since the election? So do you know yet which seats he's likely to?
No.
So in some ways, it sort of seems like cheating the system. Now, I know Brooke Page says he feels like the system is rigged in favor of Democrats who, for example, might write in Peter Welch on mm-hmm. the Republican ballot. Therefore, Peter Welch is the Republican nominee, which has happened before.
Right.
And he wants to avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, it's sort of bypassing the normal process of having voters decide who they'd like to be their elected representative. If Brooke Page wins the election in the primary election in all of these positions and then steps aside and you appoint somebody else.
Right. I see that. But also, you know, this is an open primary process. So anybody, regardless of party or what your values are on different electoral topics, you can go get the petition signatures, get on the ballot in any party you want to. And then if the voters pick you, you win. So it's not really – I mean, he's following all of the rules. That's the way the process has been written.
Which is also part of what he's saying. This is sort of an absurd process
right.
in some ways is,
right.
is part of his
and
message.
There is some value in what he's doing and making sure that, you know, Democrats or people without Republican values are able to run as Republicans.
Why can't the Vermont Republican Party get more strong candidates in to fill all of these positions?
Yeah,
in the primary to actually run in the primary.
In the primary, I think there's just, you know, it's really tough in Vermont. Your incumbency factor is so strong that a lot of people look at that as, you know, do I want to put in the time to do that? And I think a lot of the issue is a lot of our candidates are small business owners or people that are really involved in their community. And the amount of time it would take, you know, they have other priorities right now where, you know, Democrats are continually just running over and over, you know, their incumbents.
Well, not in every case.
Right.
So where do you and where does the state GOP now put its effort in these potentially new positions or in helping Don Turner get elected as lieutenant governor? I mean, what's your priority now for the November general?
Yeah, winning as many seats as possible, working with Governor Scott, Don Turner, and making sure we're able to sustain vetoes in the House. That's going to be the top priority on our side. I know that's what the Democrats are focusing on. the fight will be for the House this year.
So you're really focused on these legislative races because you don't want to see the Democrats have a veto-proof majority should Phil Scott win again in November.
When Phil Scott wins again, we want to make sure that there's a way to sustain his vetoes.
That's Jack Moulton, Executive Director of the Vermont Republican Party. I really appreciate you coming in today.
Hey,
thanks
absolutely.
Very much.
Thank you.
And we'll keep an eye on what happens now with these seats that Brooke Page has won and who potentially is put in place of Brooke Page if he withdraws from those positions. We're talking with Middlebury College political science professor Matt Dickinson and VPR's veteran political journalist Bob Kinzel. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the governor's race, and certainly there's more to talk about, but we luckily have a few more months to do that. So let's talk about some of the other races as well. Ethan from Heartland asks, why does Bernie Sanders turn down the Democratic nomination after winning it? Does that mean that another Democrat can run against him in November? Bob Kinzel, we just heard from Jack Moulton. Mm-hmm. You know, the Republican Party can put somebody in if there's nobody in that seat or if the candidate withdraws. Why doesn't that happen with Bernie?
Well, it could, but the Democratic Party isn't going to want to do that. Bernie has caucused with the Democrats ever since he was elected to Congress, both in the U.S. House and two terms in the U.S. Senate. So the Democrats count him as part of their group in Washington. And so there would be no interest on the part of the Vermont Democratic Party to meet caucus and nominate a candidate for that vacancy. So it's kind of a similar situation, but this is sort of flipped in that the Republicans would like to use this process to get some people on the ballot, and the Democrats want to use this process to keep that vacancy there.
Matt Dickinson, what do you think about what you heard from Jack Moulton?
Well, the unspoken issue here is the one you raised, which is the Republicans have trouble fielding slates of candidates in these second-tier, so-called second-tier offices. Obviously, you can't have any off chance that Brooke Page wins these in the general election. You can't have him, for instance, as state auditor auditing himself as Secretary of Treasury, as the Treasury. So it's a problem. I've pointed out something, though, which is kind of interesting. We sort of take it for granted that to be legitimate, you need to go through this primary process. And in these cases, he's just the placeholder. And the Republican Party can step in and once he decides in which party, which seats he's going to resign, appoint somebody. That, in fact, used to be how most parties filled most positions.
And works in other countries.
It works in other countries. The party actually – there's an argument to be made that we shouldn't be put people through this grueling primary, particularly when it – as I think Jack correctly points out, you can make the argument that it places burdens on some people who have private businesses or so on. There's been a longstanding argument that one reason – Republicans for a long time weren't able to take the House at the national levels. They couldn't field strong candidates because they're more involved in the private enterprises. I don't know whether that's still true, but it raises the point about there's cost to having a primary system. It's a burden on candidates that they would not face if we just allowed parties to select their own candidates through caucus systems. And so, you know, the Republican Party under this current system is disadvantaged for whatever reason. And I think this is clearly a case when you have one candidate having to run for five offices. That's not good for the Republican Party. That's not good for democracy in Vermont.
Well, Bob, what about the fact that on the progressive ballot, if you voted in the primary, you get three ballots. You get the Republican ballot, the Democrat ballot, and the Progressive Party ballot. And you fill out one and you discard the other two. So when you get the Progressive Party ballot, there are no names on it. I mean, you're welcome to write in who you want, but what does that say about the Progressive Party that they didn't field a single candidate? And in fact, you know, I was wondering why they didn't run candidates who usually have a DP by their name to at least suggest, you know, hey, we've got somebody.
Well, Jane, I think the Progressive Party is going to do what the Republican Party is thinking about doing, and that is when there's a vacancy there that the party can meet, can caucus, and can nominate a candidate, and that we're going to see that in the race for lieutenant governor, where they'll be supporting David Zuckerman. They'll be supporting some legislative candidates. They'll be supporting Auditor Doug Hoffer. And, you know, a lot of this, I think, surrounds the fact that Vermont has an open primary, and we're kind of in the middle when you look across the country. country. On one hand, you have some states that have party registration. So you actually have to be a registered member of that party in order to vote in the party's primary. Then you have the Vermont system where you can go in and, as you just mentioned, you get the three ballots and you fill out one and you discard the other two. And then you have a system like California, which is totally open. Mm-hmm. It's really not a primary, or it's not a party primary as such, because if the two top vote getters happen to be from the same party, then that's the way it is, and one of the major parties gets shut out. There's been a lot of talk about changing Vermont's open primary, but I think voters really like the way it works right now, so I'd be very surprised if lawmakers tried to change it in the future.
Let's go back to Bill in Eden and see if we have a clearer line. Hi, Bill. You're on the air again.
Thank you for getting me back in the queue. I really appreciate it. Bob Kinzel's work I've appreciated and admired for many decades. Well, maybe not that long, Bob, but I'm going to be critical. Your summation and dismissive attitude on the Stern vote as some sort of correlation to Trump voters, I think, is beneath you. I personally did not vote in the Republican primary. I switched over, if you'll excuse the expression. I'm an independent. I switched over and wrote in Mr. Rogers. But I think that you can correlate a great deal of dissatisfaction among independents and conservatives with more than just the gun issue.
Bill, I'm going to cut you off there only because we're really short on time, and I know that you want to press that point to Bob Kinzel, so I want to give him a chance to respond. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think that you'd find that Keith Stern was much more supportive of President Trump than Phil Scott has been. And that,
in fact,
he
ran partly saying, make America great again.
That's right.
Or make Vermont great again, excuse me.
What I was trying to suggest is there's a core group of Republicans in Vermont, and I think a lot of them are very supportive of President Trump. Our polls and voting seems to indicate that. So I mentioned that to say that it didn't surprise me that Keith Stern got about a third of the vote. That made a lot of sense to me.
Well, it'll be interesting to see now in the general election this question of guns, which we didn't really talk much about in today's program, because Republican voters who are disaffected with Governor Scott, who really want to see a return to the gun rules that we had before, where do they go in a Scott-Hultquist race? And what happens now for Democrats who thought they wanted to support Phil Scott in that position, who now have to choose between Phil Scott and Christine Hultquist? All of this remains to be seen. We'll have a lot of time to talk about it and really get into the policy differences of these candidates and all the other candidates now running in the general election. Matt Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College. Matt, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Pleasure to be with you, Jane.
And thanks to Middlebury College for the use of the studio. Bob Kinzel is a longtime Vermont political reporter. You hear him right here on VPR and on Vermont Edition. Bob, I always love talking with you.
My pleasure, Jane.